Wesley Clark served in the United States Army for 34 years, rose to the rank of four-star general as NATO's Supreme Allied Commander Europe, got the Presidential Medal of Freedom, ran for president back in 2004, and now is serving as an advisor, I'm sure, to his old buddy Hillary Clinton in her campaign, and has written a book called A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country. And I'm happy to welcome General Clark to KMOX this afternoon. How are you this afternoon, sir?
I'm doing just fine, thanks, and happy to be with you.
Am I correct that you're working as an advisor for Mrs. Clinton?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we haven't said anything like that. I endorsed her, and I told her, you know, I want her to become our next president.
And if she's the Democratic nominee, would you like to be her vice presidential candidate?
You know, everybody asked me that. But
well, we know you wanted to be president, and you're not running this year, so we all assume you're laying low until you can jump right back in there.
Look, I mean, I'm in the business community. I just wanted to. I would have loved to have run this year, but I just couldn't meet the preconditions. And so I just, you know, I wanted to try to help get the right person elected. She's going to have to pick whoever she thinks is best for the office. And I endorsed her because I think she's the best to be president. And what she does and who she picks and all that, that's entirely up to her.
All right. Let's leave that aside and get to the book here. The book is called A Time to Lead, and it's kind of the history of your own life in the military, your days in West Point, your days in Vietnam, right up through working in Bosnia, et cetera. And you call it A Time to Lead. Do you think we have leadership in this country now?
Well, we definitely have people in office, but it's a time for America to lead. And that's, I think this next election is going to be a struggle about who is America and what are we as Americans? Are we people who are afraid, or are we people who can face the future with confidence? Are we people who are insecure and want to build walls around the country, or are we people who are secure and want to reach out to the rest of the world? Are we going to be concerned that our values may not hold up, and so we try to protect ourselves from any competition in the way of ideas, or are we willing to engage anybody's ideas because we're confident and proud of our own values? I think those are the themes that are going to undergird the next presidential campaign.
If you were in a leadership position now, what would you do about Iraq?
I would be talking to Iran and Syria, and I'd have a major diplomatic offensive underway in the region, because the solution to Iraq is not to be found inside Iraq. Solution has to be found inside the region. Iraq is a fracture zone, a stress zone between Sunni and Shia Islam, between Iran and the Sunni nations, and so they're manipulating and using the people of Iraq for their own geostrategic purposes. You can't find the solution with 160,000 troops inside Iraq.
Are you saying we should get our troops out of Iraq?
No, I'm saying you have to have a diplomatic offensive to try to put together the right policies in the region. One of the mistakes we've been making is everyone wants to talk about troops. General Petraeus gives a testimony in Congress, but he's not in charge of the policy with respect to Iran. He doesn't have any say over whether or not we're going to talk to Syria. And until we talk to Syria and work with Iran, we're not going to find a solution for what's going on inside Iraq.
Yeah, I think the most frustrating thing about Iraq now is that the Iraqis themselves can't seem to get it together to take charge of their own country. Or am I reading this wrong?
Well, I think that there's a lot of competing interests inside Iraq. There's a lot of anger and a lot of fear. And once killing starts, it's hard to stop it. And there's a lot of killing that's happened over there. It's going to take a period of years for them to be able to get along with each other, and they may never be able to get along with each other after this. I saw the aftermath of the Balkans, and it was really painful to see what had happened there and how it had affected the people and how difficult it is. You know, when someone murders your brother or your son or your father, you don't forget that in your life. It's a very painful thing, and so we can't expect miracles over there.
What do you think of Joe Biden's idea to break the country up into three parts?
I think it's a terrible idea. It may happen, but the idea that we would support it from the United States of America, it's a terrible idea. I was the one who did the division of Bosnia. We agreed on the lines and so forth, but the line was about 3 miles wide after we'd drawn it on a map. And so after the Dayton Peace Conference was over in Dayton, Ohio, at Wright-Patt Air Force Base, I sat behind at night with the representatives and the Bosnians and the Serbs and the Muslims, and we actually argued about the line, because if you have a line that's 3 miles wide on a map and you actually look at what's on the ground underneath those 3 miles, you're talking about splitting neighborhoods, you're splitting farmers, you're splitting the house from the farmers' fields, all kinds of weird stuff happened, and we had to really pay attention to it mile by mile. It's even more confused in Iraq right now. And so the idea that you could divide the country into three zones, you might cause 1 million or 2 million people to be displaced from their homes. Who's going to provide for the new house? Who's going to give them new jobs? Who's going to prevent them from being robbed and the house looted on the way? Who's responsible for that? Well, whoever proposes it. Ethnic partition didn't solve the problems between India and Pakistan. It made them worse. And it won't solve the problems in Iraq. It may happen, but if it happens, it should be their decision, not our decision.
There was a report that came out today, General, that says that there's been a big drop-off in the last month in the deaths of American soldiers and a 50% drop-off in the deaths of Iraqi citizens.
Well, it probably means that there's less ethnic cleansing going on because a lot of the ethnic cleansing's been completed already. So it doesn't necessarily mean anything good, although I'm happy that fewer soldiers have died and fewer Iraqis are dying. We're not sure if the statistics on Iraqi deaths include all the deaths in the country. Maybe only certain deaths are included in that. But it's certainly, you know, I'm glad that we've had fewer soldiers killed this month than any month since, I think it said, July of 2006. So it's taken us a year to get back to where we were in July of 2006. I hope we can do better, but violence in Iraq, it tends to have been cyclical. The Iranians seem to have something to do with it. I hope that we are getting better intelligence. I hope we can really drive the level of violence down. But even if we do, remember, the whole point of the surge was not to reduce violence. It was to achieve a political settlement, and that doesn't appear any closer in prospect.
You mentioned Iran before. If there were proof shown to you, really true, verifiable proof that Iran was about to get to the nuclear capacity where they could create a bomb, a nuclear weapon, would you say that we should go in and do something about that militarily?
Well, I'd say that there is going to be a go-no-go point in this. We're not at that point right now. And before we get to that point, the administration owes it to the American people, to the people of Iran and everywhere else in the region, to sit down seriously and talk with the Iranians. Not just to Ahmadinejad, and not just with hostile rhetoric, and not just finger-jabbing, calling him an idiot, and so forth, but actually sit down and talk to the Iranians. Because we didn't go to war with the Soviets over Eastern Europe. Instead, we engaged the Soviets. And eventually, the Soviet domination of Eastern Europe collapsed, and people got their freedom. The population of Iran is the most pro-Western population in the region. They want engagement with the United States. So why do we want to bomb them? The answer is, we shouldn't have to. If we'll talk to them, maybe we can work this out so that they don't get a nuclear weapon.
But what if the talk doesn't work?
Well, what if it doesn't? But let's try and let's try it first. And until we do that, we won't know if it'll work. But one thing we do know for sure, that when you use force, it's easy to start a war, but it's hard to stop it. And it's also unpredictable what else may occur along that time.
Not to mention the economic impact that's going to have on all of us
exactly.
If we do that.
Exactly.
There's another.
I'm one of those who says, you know, don't use force unless it's the last resort. We're not anywhere near that close in this case.
There's another element to this war that I don't think was part of the wars that you were so active in fighting, and that is the use of private contractors, which are being used at numbers that are almost equal or maybe greater than the number of men and women we have in uniform in Iraq. What do you think of these groups, Blackwater and others?
Well, we always use private contractors to some extent. Even in Vietnam, we had at that time PA&E, I think it was Pacific Art and Engineering, that came out and they built base camps for us. And they did a lot of the engineering work because that way you didn't have to have all of the U.S. Army engineers tied up in doing routine non-military work. There's nothing wrong with that. Just like in our Army bases, we have civilians we hire to do KP, so soldiers don't spend their time washing dishes. But when you talk about using force, carrying weapons and using force to impose your will on the Iraqis, well, that's a different matter. And we've crossed the line in Iraq. I think it's been a dangerous development. We should back away from this as rapidly and expeditiously as possible. I understand it may take a few more thousand troops over there, but the use of force should be purely the province of the United States government. No private contractors, because it has to be under the control of the President of the United States and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. We're trying to win the hearts and minds of people. If we have people over there who are shooting indiscriminately or shooting without proper authority or even suspected of doing that and not under the control of the United States in a firm way, then we're compromising our own mission. It would be a mistake.
You write in the book about your rather rough childhood in Arkansas, which was still part of the Jim Crow South at that point, and you went on to engage yourself in the war in Vietnam, and then, of course, as the Supreme Commander in Europe. At what point in that long string of achievements did you ever look yourself in the mirror and say, you know what, I am a leader?
Probably never.
Never?
No, I mean, I just did what I thought was right. I never thought about whether I was a leader or not. I started leadership as a counselor at the Boys Club camp in 1959 in Little Rock, and it was a funny thing. I remember teaching a young man how to say the Camper's Creed, and he was about 9 years old, and he won a blue ribbon. And 40 years later, I was in the war in Kosovo, and I got a letter from him. He said, I'm 48 years old, and I'm a missionary in I think he said Bolivia, and you don't remember me, but you taught me to say the Camper's Creed, and I won a blue ribbon, and you helped me to make something of my life. You taught me that if I worked hard, I could be recognized and could achieve something. And I thought, gosh, that's the most wonderful letter, and I had forgotten it. Now I remember, after he wrote me the letter, I remembered it, but I hadn't thought about it. No, you just do what's required at every stage. It's not about who you are and how you think. It's about what you do. It's about performance. Leadership's about performance. It's not about how you carry yourself or how you prop yourself up when you shave in the morning in the mirror. It's about, do you get the job done? And that's the kind of leadership that I identify with. So that when you see men in the White House today who they're not getting the job done with the country, they're not taking care of America's urgent needs in infrastructure. They didn't get the job done with Katrina. They're certainly not getting the job done in the Middle East with Iraq. They're about to take us into a war with Iran. If they look themselves in the mirror and say, I'm a leader, I'd be saying, you're not a leader. You're not effective. You're not getting the kind of performance that's required. You may be occupying the position, but you're not leading.
General Wesley Clark's book is called A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country. I have a feeling we're going to be seeing you in the vice presidential debates next year, General.
I don't know, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to be out debating and doing the best I can here with this book tour to help shape American opinion.
Well,
because I think this is a critical time for America.
I appreciate you taking the time to come on this afternoon. Thank you so much.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you, sir.
General Wesley Clark here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.